Hey, can I talk to you away from the table for a second?
Sure.
So we've gotten some complaints from other players about your various accessories.
Oh, is this about my Oko and Tasiger go to the beach and rub sunscreen all over each other's glistening bodies playmat?
Yes, that, but that's not all.
Is it also because of my Gerard lounging on a rose petal-covered bed wearing tight, revealing lingerie sleeves?
Yeah, I'm not sure why you ever thought that would be okay, but there is even more.
Let me guess, people are also upset about my Quintorius is pregnant with Thalia's baby deck box?
Yep, all that stuff. I'm going to issue you a USC minor warning, and you'll need to find replacements for the rest of the tournament.
That's okay. I brought backups. I get complaints like this all the time.
So, you know that these things are likely to make players uncomfortable, but you brought them anyways?
Yes?
So in a sense, you might say you've already been warned numerous times.
Years dungeon. So I'll talk to Anthony briefly, then introduce all of you one by one, and we'll just dive into it. Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Lucky Paper Radio. My name is Andy, and I'm here as always with my co-host Anthony, the he, him, his with the soft-spoken Riz Maddox.
Sure, I'll take it.
I couldn't decide how cringe that was going to be to say out loud. It didn't feel as bad as I thought it might sound in my head.
Okay, it was weird for me, so.
Surely a new record for the earliest possible editor's interjection here, but I just want to clarify that I meant it was cringe because I was a 35-year-old man using the word Riz, not because I was giving Anthony's pronouns. That part was not cringe, just me saying Riz. Whew. Yeah, I mean, we're 193 or 4 episodes into this podcast. We've never actually said our pronouns on air because you and I benefit from the fact that A, this is a male-dominated hobby. B,
that's fair to say.
And B, our names and voices are most likely to be assumed to use male pronouns. So we've never bothered to mention it before. Maybe we should. Maybe we should be setting the standard, the norm, so that people that don't have those two benefits we just have don't have to feel like they're out of place for mentioning it in other podcasts. But you know, 95% of the time, it's just you and I on mic. We've never even bothered mentioning that, but we both do use he, him pronouns. And I'm mentioning that because this week's episode is all about making your playgroup more accountable and more inclusive, which is a subject that is something we've wanted to talk about for a while, Anthony. It's something that you and I have talked about behind the scenes, and I think is really important. You know, the community building aspect of this show has become a really important part of this show for me, this kind of emerging theme of us talking about how to help people build their local playgroups, find people to play with, and make the game a bigger part of their life. But frankly, you and I are not the best people to talk about making a place more accountable or inclusive because, like I said, you and I are the overrepresented group in the vast majority of Magic spheres. So because of that, we are not alone in this episode. We are very not alone, in fact. This will be the most guests we've ever had on a single episode of Lucky Paper Radio. First, we are joined by Tara Robertson. Her pronouns are she and her. Hi, Tara. She is a diversity, equity, and inclusion consultant from Vancouver. And Tara, I don't think I told you this, but I emailed like 6 or 7 different DEI specialists and consultants that I found online to try and get somebody who was willing to talk to us about this weird thing, right? Like, I imagine most of your clients are businesses or not-for-profits or whatever that are like working on some form of power structures. And I'm like, we play a game and we have a podcast and we want to help people be better about their local communities. And everybody else either didn't respond to me or responded and said, thanks, no thanks, except for you. And we had a great phone call, and you have been very enthusiastic about learning about this game. So welcome to the show.
Thanks.
We also have Jen the Judge, who is a level 2 judge, the staff manager for next year's KubeCon event, and the CFO of Gender Inclusive Gaming. And on top of it all, a grassroots labor organizer, so really setting the bar quite high. Their pronouns are they and them. Welcome to the show, Jen.
Thank you very much.
I understand you're fresh off of your first major event that you were the head judge of at PAX East this past weekend.
Yes, PAX East was run this year by Esports Admin, a company I have never worked for before, but I'm very happy to have said I have worked for now. It was a wonderful experience, and the convention ran super smoothly.
Great. Congratulations on that. I imagine that's very stressful. I can't imagine being in charge of a huge event like that.
It's one of those things that's very stressful the first couple times you do it, and at some point yelling at large groups of Magic players becomes enjoyable second nature.
Just becomes old hat. And finally, we also have the CEO of Gender Inclusive Gaming, which is the nonprofit that runs the VML, the one I just mentioned that Jen is the CFO of, which is a tournament series for marginalized genders, and a professional Magic the Gathering tournament broadcaster. Her pronouns are also she and her. It's Hayu. Welcome to the show, Hayu.
Thanks, Andy. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Now we got everybody accounted for, introduced. Let's talk about what we're talking about here, because I think the terminology is actually important. And Tara, you actually, you know, Anthony and I are here mostly to learn, I should say. And I've already learned a lot just from planning in this episode. Tara, you pointed out that our original idea for the sort of topic was making a playgroup that was more inclusive and safer. And you pointed me to a great resource, which we're going to link in the show notes, of course, about why the terminology might not make the most sense. So I don't know if Tara, maybe you want to talk about like what we mean when we mention an inclusive or an accountable space.
Yeah, so the initial thing around safety, like, what does that mean anyways? When some people say in corporate spaces, we want to have a safe conversation or we want to have a brave conversation, I'm like, what does that mean? Like, safe for who? What kind of bravery? I want to be explicit about what we all care about, like the values that we want in a space, and I want us to hold ourselves and each other accountable. So if we say that we value inclusion, like, let's take care and say people's names correctly and use their pronouns, use the right pronouns that people use for themselves. Like, that's a behavior that shows that value. And for me, like, safety is also kind of tricky because what's safe for me today may not be safe tomorrow, or what's safe for me may not be safe for you. So being explicit about what our values, the behaviors that support those values, and then having accountability around that's important for me.
I love that idea of just being explicit about values, because I think that a lot of this could sound like we're all trying to say there is one right way to build a community. I think that's probably not the case. I think for a lot of players, you know, they might have their tight-knit three or four people that are their buds they want to play with on a weekly basis. So maybe the values that work for them are not going to be the same for a playgroup like mine and Andy's. So we are trying to be growing the group and getting more different perspectives and different players involved. So just, yeah, being clear about that and making sure it is about how do you actually translate those values into behavior.
Like, I make up that fun is a value that most people here share. Like, I don't play myself, but I play other games and I play them because they're fun and they're interesting and I get to use my brain in a different way and connect with people in a different way. Like, if it's not fun, I don't want to do it. So,
right.
And then what do we mean by fun? I worked for a global tech company and we said, you know, use common sense. Well, what does that mean? Like, we come from different backgrounds. So being explicit about the specifics are important.
Yeah, the biggest takeaway I had from that article you shared was that I've definitely seen people advertise before that they are creating a safe space for something, right? This is a safe space for X, a safe space for Y. And the article just pointed out that you can't ever promise that. Like, you can never promise that this space will actually be safe for anybody that shows up, because you're not in control of all the other people in that space. As much as you might want to have rules or expectations, it's not actually something you can guarantee. And so kind of avoiding that language makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. If I could just jump in on the safe space conversation, I think, Tara, what you're bringing up is very valuable, because at the VML, you know, we have tried to develop this Discord community, which is only open to people of marginalized genders and magic. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, how safe is the space, etc. And we try to make sure that our values are enforced, we have good moderation, but ultimately, and there have been incidents, there have been issues with people who we've had to deal with, or behaviors that we had to deal with, or even attacks, organized attacks from other groups on the internet. So when those things happen, you know, we don't kind of beat ourselves up about it and say we didn't protect everyone 100%, but we think it's really about the response that you give, and the community members respond well when they know that the leadership, you know, has their back or is doing the right thing.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Really, why we've called this brain trust together today, this committee, is to talk about how people in their own local communities that find themselves in what I think are largely going to be informal positions of leadership, right? Like, Anthony, you were kind of the person that really sat down and said, you know, 2 years ago, we're going to cube every Tuesday night and we're just going to make it happen. And there's no formal title associated with that. You don't have any actual powers in any venue that anybody else doesn't have. But in doing that, you became a very much an informal leader of the community. And I think a lot of our listeners are going to be in the same place. We hear from people all the time that are trying to do what we did here in Baltimore, or they have their own playgroup and they're trying to foster it and grow it responsibly. And this episode is about how to do that with an eye towards accountability and inclusivity to try and make your playgroup as good as it can be. First, I want to establish just quickly that there is actually a problem to be addressed, because I've posted about this online a couple times, and a lot of times people get at me in the comments and are just like, well, you know, my playgroup is perfectly diverse. It must be a problem with you. Or, you know, is this actually an issue, or is it just an overblown sort of PR thing? And yeah, it is. I mean, first of all, the hardest fact I can give is that 93% of the people listening to this right now are male, roughly speaking. You know, the analytics are a little fuzzy, but definitely the vast majority of our listeners are male for sure. And every indication we've ever had of the breakdown gender-wise of the Magic player population always skews pretty heavily male. It depends, you know, where you're looking, where you're asking, and you can find different numbers over the years that Mark Rosewater has mentioned on his blog. The most recent one that we can find is that the breakdown is 62% to 38% male to female. Obviously, that doesn't account for non-binary folks, so the fact that it adds up to exactly 100 doesn't quite make sense, but it is definitely a very male-dominated space, at the very least. And then, just anecdotally, talking specifically about Cube, looking at Cube playgroups that post their pictures on social media, looking at the attendance of the KubeCon event and the Ice Cube and other kind of Cube events, and looking at the breakdown of conversations that go on in various online forums, pretty much everywhere you turn, it is white, male-dominated, almost exclusively. So there is a big disparity in the Magic world more broadly in terms of what players feel welcome and feel like the game is for them and show up on a regular basis.
Speaking of last year's KubeCon, definitely, like, overwhelmingly, it is an organization. It is a convention that is overwhelmingly white. But it is also, I think, important to keep in mind that KubeCon is, in my experience, one of the most diverse conventions that I have ever attended. Even though it is overwhelmingly a white male dominated space, still there are more like out queer people at that convention, a higher percentage than any other convention I've been to. Mark Rosewater's numbers about average player count, as you said, are like already fairly male skewed, but and at the convention scene and competitive Magic, it is significantly more so.
Absolutely.
When we started the VML back in 2020, one of the reasons was really that a lot of us came from the old Grand Prix circuit, like the old competitive circuits. And, you know, I still remember the first time I walked into a room and there were 1,500 men and, you know, 30 femme looking people or something. Like you could go around and count every single one. It was actually a very overwhelming feeling. And I'm not somebody that gets overwhelmed easily, but it was a shock.
Yeah, I like both those points. And I think it emphasizes something which I want to mention here, which is that I think that this is not a binary. It's not like, well, your group is either inclusive or it's not, right? It's not like we're striving for exactly a 50-50% break of, you know, representation of all genders and ethnicities, right? Like, it's not like we're aiming for these particular milestones or benchmarks. It's that you want a community where everybody feels welcome, and you can oftentimes look at these numbers being skewed and see that as evidence that that is not the case right now. So yeah, I think that's a good point, Jen, that yeah, I think KubeCon compared to other Magic events was definitely a lot more diverse, a lot more welcoming. There were more queer folks there than I've seen at other Magic events, but that's not to say that, like, you know, the work is done, obviously. It might be a sign that in the Cube space, people do feel a little more comfortable than maybe in Magic more broadly in more competitive structured contexts, but I think the way to look at this is you want to be doing the work, and hopefully these are evidence that you're putting in that effort, not that you're trying to, like, check a box, and then once you've checked it, you're, like, good to go.
Andy, can I jump in with a question for you?
Please.
I remember our first call, and you were saying, you know, Magic's also really white, and I'm like, you're in Baltimore. Like, I'm in Canada on the West Coast, so I've never been to Baltimore, but from what I know, it's not super white.
No, definitely not.
So I was like, who are the Black game organizers like you? Like, who is your equivalent in the Black community? And you're like, I don't know. But, like, there are more Black people playing, and I can't remember which game you mentioned. But
it
you're
was
like,
Yu-Gi-Oh!
Yeah. And I was like, why is that?
You know, I never got to a good answer for that question, but the anecdote I had shared with you, Tara, I'll share with everybody now, which is that a couple times I've been to a Magic event at one of the much bigger game stores that's actually, like, just on the city outskirts. It's, like, kind of just across the line of the county. It's not my normal stomping grounds, but I've been there for, like, a few events, and most of the times I'm there for an event, there are multiple events going on concurrently, and it's amazing the difference in just audience and player base when you look at, well, here's the people here for this legacy event, and it's 95% like middle-aged white dudes. And then on the other side of the room are people here for whatever Yu-Gi-Oh! Event is going on, and it's 85% young people of color. And it's like, there's really weird like disparities there that I don't have a great explanation for, but I look at it as evidence of the fact that Magic has a lot of work to do to be the kind of game that everyone feels welcome in.
That, and like, there's also the history of redlining in the U.S. So where people live is often racially homogenous. So
extremely.
I have no answers, but I'm just like, why is it this way? And yeah.
Yeah, this is not the venue for us to unpack all of the various racist housing policies of Baltimore over the years, but suffice it to say there are a lot of resources on the subject. And even though Baltimore does skew heavily black, the white populations tend to live in the same neighborhoods and people tend to kind of stick to their local clusters of areas. So my experience in Baltimore, my peer group is mostly white people, even though I live in a city that is predominantly black.
I can speak a bit to kind of the different communities. Among my many jobs in kind of the Magic the Gathering space is I am the head judge for a game store in Brooklyn, New York, a newly unionized game store in Brooklyn, New York.
Hell yeah.
And we run Digimon, we run Magic the Gathering, we run Pokemon, and we're in Brooklyn. Brooklyn is a fairly racially diverse area, one of the more diverse parts of the U.S. And still, even here, it is Magic is not uniformly, but overwhelmingly white. Digimon is overwhelmingly people of color. And more frequently than not, the people of color playing Magic in the store got into Magic because they came to the store playing Digimon or Pokemon. It is just kind of that there is a wall to climb to get back to a more proportional community because Magic has been so overwhelmingly white for so long.
Absolutely. I also want to say to people listening, if you do have a super diverse playgroup and you are putting a lot of effort into inclusivity, then that's awesome. I want you to know your playgroup is not the norm, so like your experience does not negate the fact that there are still plenty of spaces where Magic is this game that is dominated by white men, basically. Really, this episode maybe is not for you, right? Like, if you've already got a really diverse playgroup, I hope you can get something out of this, but we're really kind of aiming this at the people that do have some work to do, and I include Anthony and I in our playgroup here in Baltimore in that group of people.
I mean, sometimes it's not really, like you said earlier, Andy, it's not really about quotas or, you know, have you checked this box in a way, because plenty of people from marginalized backgrounds love Magic and they go to play in groups or they join groups because, you know, it's what they have access to, it's what's closest to them, but they're kind of suffering in them despite the right. fact that they're there, if that makes sense. Like they still face a lot of barriers, a lot of behaviors that don't really let them be comfortable or participate in the way that other people are, but because they love the game so much, like that's the only thing they have access to. And that's something that we see quite a lot with people coming in through online spaces, is they say, well, in my local area, I have to go to this store, I have to go to this group because that's all I have.
Yeah, which, you know, I also want to make the argument to people that are listening, you know, the most common question we get from listeners is about how to get seven other people in the same room to fire a pod. And Tara, for your benefit, the way we play Magic, mostly, for the most part, the best way to do it is to get exactly eight people in the same room, which is really tricky to have eight and not nine and not seven, you know, and not have somebody feeling left out. And so,
but even just getting eight people, it is a real right. challenge for people that listen to the show to just get those people together. So there's this active need to recruit more people into the hobby.
Yeah, and that's the question we get most often. And I think that some people's first reaction to us introducing these ideas into the conversation might be that it feels like it's more work or more barriers, or it's like more things that's going to make it harder for them to do this, right? Like, I'm just trying to get eight people. I don't have time to think about how to make this like an accountable or inclusive space because I just need eight people. What I want them to know is that this is how you do it, right? Like, this is one of the ways that you increase your pool of available players to actually fill those pods, right? And grow your playgroup and find yourself playing with more different kinds of people. We've actually gotten questions twice now from two separate listeners because, you know, I took to posting pictures of our Tuesday night drafts on Twitter, I don't know, maybe a year ago. I've been doing it pretty much every Tuesday. And in traditional Joe Anderson fashion, I'll often take like a selfie of like people sitting around the draft table and, you know, me in the front. And I think we have a long way to go still in terms of making our playgroup a accountable and inclusive space. But a couple times we've gotten messages from people that are like, wow, of the 16 people you have to draft tonight, like, three of them are femme presenting. That's more than I've ever seen in my hometown, right? Like, that's more diverse than anything I've ever been able to get access to. And so what I really want people to, like, take away from this is that this is one of the ways you can just make sure that you have a bigger pool of players to pull from to make this thing happen. And for a lot of us, Cube has been a really great positive impact in our lives. And as you just mentioned, Hayu, for a lot of people, there's one place where Magic is played that's accessible to them that they can walk to or make it to easily or take public transit to. And if that space is crappy, if it doesn't make them feel welcome, if it's a toxic space to some degree, then that's really a bummer for those players. So I think we all have kind of a moral obligation too to, in these spaces, just make sure that they are as accountable and inclusive as they can be, because this is a valuable thing for people.
Also for Cube specifically, like, as I'm sure anybody with a Cube can attest, one of the best ways to improve your Cube is have more people playing it.
Yeah.
If you have the same 8 people every week, it can be difficult to innovate because people tend to stick to things they know, stick to things that they know are good. Some people just like archetypes better than others. It can be a huge boon to, like, your personal Cube just to have more people, different people, people of different thought processes and backgrounds in your Cube environment saying, hey, what if you tried this? What if you focused on this kind of niche interaction?
That is very true, Jen. You just reminded me that I was invited to a vintage Cube group here, just killed everyone with Mind Twist, and then has not been invited back since.
So you can also, fail to make friends if you Mind Twist them too hard, it turns out.
Yeah, I think it was my behavior that was toxic on that.
But within the boundaries they set, they put it in the Cube. So you were acting, entirely within the expectations of the group.
Demonstrating the problem with Mind Twist. I think that's a great point, and I think a lot about sort of all of the things that happen adjacent to the game. I love Magic and I enjoy that, but I also enjoy hosting people and cooking a meal and talking about, oh, you're into this like interesting computer science topic, or you're a knitter or something. It's just, there's all this value just from having diverse perspectives at the table. But for a lot of people, maybe they don't put a lot of emphasis on it, and it really is just about the cards and playing. And if that's it, diversity still benefits you because you are, like you're saying, just going to have a lot more different perspectives on the game itself, which is, I think, a really true and powerful point.
One of a great example, I think, a very close friend of mine has a wonderful Commander Cube that I get to draft as frequently as humanly possible. And all the time we're just drafting really cool 2 and 3 color decks. And my girlfriend came to draft it with me one time and spent the entirety of pack one picking fixing, and then just drafted every single best card in every pack and demolished everyone. And it was a very clear indication that fixing was too good in the cube. And we had just never put that together. The 8 people who regularly draft had never thought that this strategy would be so dominant. And we tried it a few times, like we ran it back a couple times just to make sure this wasn't a fluke. And we very quickly determined that it was genuinely just way too strong, and a lot of fixing needed to be removed from the cube. Otherwise, 5 color good stuff was just so dominant.
You're about to start a different fight with Andy here. I can see this.
Can I be invited?
I was just going to say, Jen, we have to have you back on the show in the future to talk about the problem with 5 color good stuff and ways to approach it, because it's a whole other topic there. But yeah,
it's my hottest cube take. I think 5 color good stuff is boring.
I actually totally agree. We can't go down this road. It's so tempting.
Pause. Put that in the next episode.
We're putting it on pause. We're going to talk. We are genuinely going to have you back to talk about it. But to your broader point, yeah, having different players with different, skill. I mean, one of the most beautiful things about Magic is that it is so broad that you can't be great at every aspect of it. Really, you can't. Like, you look at the best players in the world and they still have aspects of the game where they thrive and aspects where they are weaker than the other top players. And one of the best ways to get better and just to, really sink yourself into this thing you love is to surround yourself with more people that each have, different perspectives in the game and you can learn from. So there's like every possible conceivable benefit to putting in the work to make your playgroup a more accountable and more inclusive space.
I'm hearing 3 or 4 reasons about why this is an important topic. So one, it's a game you all love and you want more people to love it. It's hard to get 8 people out. So limiting the communities and people you connect with limits being able to get 8 people out. Jen just made the point around innovation. If you're always playing with the same people, you likely have the same blind spots or have the same way, a similar way of thinking, and you might not see that a card is overpowered or something like that.
That was a great summer. You should be hosting this, not me.
I mean, I would say the last aspect to why I think this is important, which is maybe just sort of reframing everything that we're saying, but to your point, Tara, I'm kind of embarrassed by it. Like, the fact that we are in a very black city and we have such a white playgroup is... it's uncomfortable, you know, and if I'm going to, I have this sort of niche hobby and it's kind of dorky and people have this sort of image issue with what this hobby is all about. So if I'm meeting a new potential friend, I don't know, maybe a romantic interest, and it's like, I play Magic and here's this group of people I spend a bunch of time with and they're just a bunch of white dudes. Like, that is not a flattering image or something that I'm excited to sort of like share that aspect of my community. So I'm just motivated to have a more representative community of the broader community that we live in.
But that's not an uncommon thing in the United States and Canada as well. Mm-hmm. A lot of us live in racially segregated worlds, and that's a shame. And if you could connect with people of other races over the game that you love, maybe then those conversations spread to talking about social policy or talking about union activism or housing or other things that are broadly more important. But you could connect on something like a passion and a game that you really, really love. Our worlds in 2020 with the murder of George Floyd, like, there was a lot of well-intentioned kind of things said by white people around wanting, being horrified by racism and wanting to change things. And not a lot's changed. So I don't know. I kind of believe the weirdos and the geeks were the ones who are going to connect on interests, maybe, and maybe that will spread. I don't know. I'm hopeful.
I was really struck, Tara, because we were talking about our playgroup, and there's definitely ways our playgroup, I think, can improve in terms of being an accountable and inclusive space. We have plenty of room for improvement, but there's also ways in which this group of people that we play this game with is among the most diverse groups of people that I think adults in their mid-30s ever, you know, engage with, right? Like, in this game, you know, in our local playgroup, there is a huge range of just income, right? Like, there's people that we play with that are medical doctors. There's people we play with that work in tech and make six figures. There's people we play with that work in the service industry. And we get together every Tuesday and share this game together. And on that particular point, a huge part of that is that it's Cube. You don't have to bring your own cards. You just show up and you get to play, which is a kind of a implicit and like automatic leveler in terms of just bringing everyone to the same level and letting them play the same game. It's also really diverse in terms of age, right? Like, there's people in our playgroup in their like late 40s, people in our playgroup in their early 20s, and kind of everywhere in between.
I think our youngest player last week was 12.
We did have a do you count the 6-year-old or the 8-year-old that had their dad drafting
sure,
with
counting
them?
It
we had some kids last Aww. Week too. So, you know, when I look at my friends that don't play Magic, they don't have friends from wildly different economic backgrounds or of wildly different ages for the most part. And so it's beautiful that this game can bring us together. And you mentioned something when we were talking about this at first, Tara. You were like, that's amazing that you have this space where people can, in these ways in which they're wildly different, still share space together and have a shared experience around something they both love.
But I don't think that's an accident. What did you do to create that space? Or what are you doing that keeps people coming back?
You really are a much better host than me. You keep showing me up. That's a great transition, because we've talked a lot about the nature of this issue and maybe why you ought to care about it. But I think the meat of this conversation should be about what people can do. And I'll be honest, I went looking for resources when we started planning this episode, and a lot of the things I found, they don't have really practical advice. They don't say, like, you can go out this week and do X to actually help make an effort towards inclusivity. And so I think it's what we should mostly talk about. And Jen, you and I actually had a Twitter exchange about this back in January, where we were talking about this. I posted it asking a similar question, which is how we originally got connected and why you're talking to us now. And you had a couple of ideas you posted on Twitter I was hoping you could expand on here. Shall I read the tweets, or do you just want to kind of jump in and talk about the ideas? How do you want to handle it?
Definitely do read the tweets, because my memory is that of a goldfish, and I do not remember exactly what I said.
No problem. I will read them. You said, have a true zero tolerance policy on problematic behavior towards women or queer people. If people violate that, immediately and publicly correct them and warn them that next time they will be banned.
Yeah, this one... this one is definitely informed by my experiences as a judge. Competitive Magic tournaments are run under a couple documents. One of them is the Infraction Procedure Guide, which dictates how judges are supposed to fix problems both within a game and like interpersonal problems that may arise during a tournament. Most of these policies have warnings associated with them for first-time offenses. Generic problematic behavior is one of them. Targeted problematic behavior is a completely different story. That escalates much faster, but most times playgroups or individuals will not jump directly toward that kind of targeted behavior. People test the waters of like, they're like, I have these beliefs, I want to be able to share them because that's human nature. And they test the waters by being kind of generally problematic or kind of low-key problematic. And shutting that down immediately, making it known that that's not tolerated, these people sort themselves out of tournaments, out of playgroups very quickly when they realize that. I'm sure most people who have played Magic for a long enough time will have some thought that jumps into their head when thinking about problematic behavior that they've seen.
We've always
seen,
yeah.
Like, it's incredibly important for people organizing cube play groups. That kind of goes to the players as well. Tournament organizers, whether they be huge ones like at conventions or even local ones running 8-16 person cube events, they can't see everything. They can't hear everything. The TOs definitely should, if they see or hear stuff, crack down on that quickly and firmly. But it can go a long way if you are a player and you hear somebody say something like kind of casually sexist, just being like, hey, that kind of sucked. Like that sort of shame is like amazingly effective with people with these kind of regressive policies, because we are benefited in some way by the fact that people generally feel slightly ashamed being regressive and rude to people. Not everyone, but a lot of people. And just hitting them with some very light shame can often be all that's needed to let them know that that's just not appropriate or accepted.
And don't leave it up to people to defend themselves. I mean, many people will want to defend themselves, and that's obviously great and should be supported. But I think that a lot of the time when you're in that marginalized position, you feel very isolated. And having somebody else speak up, somebody who's in the overrepresented group or maybe has social influence or even formal influence over the situation, having them speak up is like having them say, I'm on your side. You know, you're not alone. You don't have to face this alone. And so for people who have trouble speaking up, I think people get into this pattern where they think, oh, I don't want to fight people's battles for them, or I want to deal with this quietly or whatever it is. But I really urge both you and your listeners to kind of speak up. You know, it doesn't, like Jen says, it can be light. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to get really angry. You don't have to get very heated, but speaking up is just makes such a difference to people.
I love that point. And I think most people that are in a position where they could speak up and don't are really just kind of frozen by what they perceive to be social graces, right? They don't want to have any kind of conflict, even a minor one, with somebody. And, you know, I would definitely encourage everybody listening as a player to just get more willing and, you know, practice doing that. And I think doing it in a way that is maybe not so serious and light, like you mentioned, Jen, is great. You know, especially if the infraction is relatively mild, you know, it's a thing you don't want to, like, you know, start kicking people out of the playgroup for, but you definitely want to not continue or to, you know, not be encouraged, then getting in the habit of just having a polite way to check people, I think, is really good. But this goes doubly so if you are in a position of informal leadership. And I think a lot of people that have their own cube and are organizing drafts do not recognize or accept that they are in a position of social capital, but they actually are. And for those people, I think it's even more important. And if you're somebody that maybe is not like me, who is loud and shameless and willing to offend people in public at the drop of a hat, if you are, you know, a more soft-spoken person, that's something I would recommend that you, like, really think about and, you know, just practice. Like, think about what you're going to say word for word if somebody says something passingly sexist or passingly racist or somehow xenophobic, and, you know, what your exact wording is going to be to point out that it's not the kind of behavior you want to foster, but also not try and make somebody feel like they're being attacked or whatever. And it sucks, right? Like, in some ways, very broadly, right? Like, it shouldn't be on everybody to like police his behavior. It should be on these people to just do better. But the reality is that people aren't perfect. And so if you want to have a space that is accountable, then you have to, you know, start holding people accountable. I wondered if we might want to more carefully define problematic behavior, because I think some obvious things like, you know, direct insults or objectifying or just like straight up harassing people, like I hope we don't have to explain that that's problematic behavior. But I think there's a lot of much more subtle things that, you know, I have read people's experiences in the game if they're of a marginalized identity, and these kind of microaggressions that just pile up and just really make you feel like it's a not a space for you or that you're unwelcome there, that I kind of want to like just walk through. One that comes up a lot is insinuating or assuming that somebody you're playing against is not a serious player or doesn't know the game very well because they don't have the identity you've come to associate with a Magic player. You know, people get questions like, did your boyfriend teach you to play, to somebody in an event? Or people get more frustrated when they lose to somebody who is like a woman because they think that women are not as good at Magic or can't possibly be as invested as them, therefore they should have won.
Or maybe a more subtle thing even, it's just like, who do you turn to in a room full of people you don't know if you have a rules question?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, a really subtle one that actually ticks me off when people do it to me is just when people play their cards facing me because they assume I have to read it, which in some ways is like nice because it's making it more accessible, but I also know you're kind of implying that I have to read the card, and maybe I actually know what that one does, so I'll ask you if I have to read it. Little things like this, you know, may seem not that important to you. If you've always felt welcome in Magic, these might seem like little tiny things that couldn't possibly make a difference, but I can tell you from talking to friends that are not from those overrepresented groups that it does. It really does matter over time.
If you're listeners, if you're like, oh, none of these things have ever happened to me, or that wouldn't bother me, that's probably a sign that you've got some privilege. And privilege isn't a bad thing, but not everyone moves through the world the same way that you do. And having privilege means that you can speak up with less potential threat to your identity or position in a group. So if you're like, wow, like I never thought of these things before, like there's a reflection point there for you.
That's a great point. And when you are in that space where you are pushed to speak up, where you see something happen that is behavior you don't want to encourage, and you feel that little like social pressure of like, ah, I don't want to cause conflict, just imagine somebody who doesn't have all your privilege that is feeling that little pang of like, I don't want to have social conflict, and also the much bigger pang of, if there is social conflict, I might be ostracized. I might not be invited back. Like, much bigger things that you don't have to worry about if you are in the majority.
I think a lot of these things also are just, you know, people think they're not an issue because, so you sit down, somebody shows you, plays their cards upside down so you can read them, and maybe you think that's not an issue, but if you're somebody that happens to week in, week out, you know, every new store you go to, people are going to assume the same thing. It's like death by a thousand cuts, right? Like, it's very wearying to be in that position where you're constantly having to deal with this stuff instead of it's an occasional annoyance that, you know, is this just one? It happens every so often. And, right, you know, like we were talking about, oh, if you invite people, more diverse people to your cube group, you can get more diverse ideas on how to improve your cube or how it plays, etc. And that's true, but that's only true if you actually respect the opinions of the people you invited. There's something about being in that space where, you know, you can be a marginalized person, you can be playing, well, and then you get into a conversation and just your opinion is just not taken seriously because people think or they assume that they're going to know more about it than you. And I have certainly had this experience where I've sat, and I'm a big Limited player, big fan, and I had, you know, I'm just sat and I'm surrounded by a circle of like three or four guys, and they're all telling me why I'm wrong about something, and I know I'm not, like, because I play a lot of Magic and I'm involved in, you know, competitive Magic and stuff. And so it's just that dynamic of having people there, great, but like actually giving them the same amount of respect and consideration that you give, you know, the more privileged people.
God, that is such a great point. And it also highlights how, you know, we're mostly talking about what not to do here, right? Like, here's the kind of behavior you shouldn't allow. But a lot of these have a corollary, which is kind of going out of your way to make sure that the opposite happens, right? You know, something I try and do whenever there's somebody new that shows up to our playgroup every Tuesday. You know, we have a regular cycle of, let's say, 24 people, of which 2/3 of which come out every Tuesday. And there was always a couple wild cards, people that, you know, are in town traveling, or they're out for the first time just seeing what this is all about. You know, I always make an effort just to ask them if they have any ideas about my draft pool, right? Because if I'm building my draft pool and I'm always going to my friends and asking them what they think about, then it kind of sends this message that there's like an in-group and an out-group. And it just goes so far just to ask somebody who's new, hey, what would you cut? I need one more cut from my list here. You know, what was the card you would take out of this list? So little things like that can go a long way, I think.
Hi, I just wanted to say that all of your points are so excellent. I was like nodding and furiously like, yes. And I think what you said is like, it's diversity without inclusion. Like the token diversity stuff's like, yay, we've got a diverse group of people, but we don't actually treat people well. Like, so like 8+1 to everything you said.
I was just thinking the same thing about you, Tara.
Aw.
Tara and I are going to go out for drinks after this.
Yeah, I'm jealous that you're together in the same city. Jen, I know that you mentioned that you thought it would be relevant to talk about explicit sleeves or playmats or other gaming paraphernalia. I imagine this comes up more than it should as a judge, but...
Shockingly frequently. Yeah, this is, in addition to being like a genuinely important issue and a constant problem in the Magic community, this is like my personal crusade, because I think it's so stupid. So for those, I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar. For those who may not be, there are a lot of people who show up to their local game store with sleeves or playmats that are just not appropriate for public consumption and just kind of inherently degrading toward femme-presenting people. And it exists, they exist currently in this weird gray area of there is no specific rules in the Magic rules and the Magic infraction procedure guide that dictate this. It's kind of covered under generally harassing behavior. And what imagery specifically counts as generally problematic behavior, generally harassing behavior, it depends a lot on who you ask. And I have had very rousing discussions with other judges about where that line specifically should be drawn. This is, unsurprisingly, it's a pretty frequent Twitter discourse, but this was the Magic Twitter discourse a couple days ago.
Yeah, it was recent.
Yes. And just stop. Don't do that. There are so many great playmats and sleeves that you can get that don't overly sexualize women and make femme-presenting people in your playgroup uncomfortable. I had rather recently a player in an event that I was running had a deck box that was inappropriate. And when I mentioned it, like I mentioned, like, hey, this the interior of this deck box specifically is very inappropriate. Please ensure that you keep it closed. He mentioned that this was not the first time he had a judge talk to him about it.
Really telling on yourself there.
Wow.
And in hindsight, I think I 100% should have given him a penalty in that case. Like, the warning is supposed to be a courtesy. But if you have been warned that your behavior in the past is poor because you have this deck box that... I'm sure a lot of people know exactly what deck box I'm talking about. The outside, very normal. You open it up, it has a naked woman on the inside. I'm sure an unfortunately large percentage of the Magic player base knows exactly the deck box I'm talking about. The warning is a courtesy. Don't bring it to events. If you know that you aren't supposed to bring it to events and you know that it's inappropriate at events and you keep bringing it, you are the problem in this situation.
And in regards to where the line is, can we not just say if you're ever questioning if it's over the line, it's definitely over the line? Like, we shouldn't even be talking about the line. Just
I really
like, why have you chosen to bring this? You know, like, what's the purpose?
I wish we could put the line there, but having some sort of codified line, I think, helps judge brain a little bit. But this is this is a topic that I crusade against constantly, and I constantly am telling players, just put the playmat away. Like, there's so much good Magic art that you can get playmats made of. You can buy them from the artists to support the Magic artists. There are so many really high quality sleeves from a lot of different companies that don't have horrifically offensive imagery on it. The cost to you is negative because generally you have to pay more for these sleeves and deck boxes than you do for just regular ones. And I find it so infuriating because it is an incredibly easy example of people actively choosing to do things that they know, maybe not outwardly, but inwardly know that a portion of the player base does not like these and finds them
distasteful at best and uncomfortable at worst.
So this is not about explicit playmats exactly, but it is in the same vein. And by the way, Jen, I 100% support your crusade. I was at a GP, this was pre-pandemic, so there were maybe 2,000 people in this convention hall. And I see somebody and they're wearing, you know, they're wearing a jacket, but the jacket's open and their t-shirt says Race Wars on it. Like, and it's in the like Star Wars font. So it's like, imagine the Star Wars logo, but instead it says Race Wars. And I'm like, that's not okay. So I went to the tournament organizer and I said, hey, there's someone in this room. And I pointed him out and I said, look, this person is wearing a t-shirt that says Race Wars. Please tell them to cover it up. Like, and so the tournament organizer, you know, said, okay, we'll handle it. So then I came back to them later to check whether they had handled it, because I am that person that complains and then comes back to check that you have done something about my complaint.
It's called accountability.
Yeah, accountability. And the tournament organizer said to me, and this is a very major tournament organizer, said to me, oh, you know, we Googled it, and actually this is the logo of some drag racing community in the local area or something. It was, you know, so there was some thing that it was meant to be a witty kind of take on.
Some well, actually.
Yeah. And I just looked at the tournament organizer and said, how am I supposed to know that if I see a t-shirt that says Race Wars from across a room? And I could just see the light bulbs kind of going off in their minds, like, oh, we shouldn't just be defending this random person wearing a Race Wars t-shirt. We should try and do something about it.
Both of these are really good examples of, I think, one way in which most of our listeners and all of these informal playgroups, you know, across the world are actually better off than big events like this, right? Because I am a computer programmer and a systems thinker, and I am sympathetic to the fact that it's probably really hard to write a completely binary black and white rule that defines what kind of playmat is across that line or what kind of t-shirt is not okay to have.
And if you make that line, then people know exactly how far they
can go. People are going to abuse it. They're going to go right up to that line and dance on it. Whereas in your local playgroup, you don't have to be, you don't have to have strict, you know, black and white rules for these things. You can just say, hey, the vibes are off. We don't like the vibes of that shirt. No more of that, please. You don't have to have such strict rules that you have to completely adhere to. Though I think it is, we'll probably get to it later, important to, you know, be clear and communicative about what expectations are. We don't have to train staff with documents that are unambiguous in terms of how these things ought to be handled. You get to kind of go based on your gut.
Can I just summarize what I heard? So don't bring porny type stuff and don't bring racist white supremacy stuff either. And if you're not sure, maybe err on the side of caution. What are people doing?
Yeah, it's crazy that it has to be said, Tara. And in the case of most of our listeners, I hope it doesn't have to be said, but it should be said. Don't let anyone show up to your cube draft and pull out their anime waifu playmat, right? Like, you should be... To say you should be expecting this is really, really kind of a negative view, but you should be prepared for how you will handle such a situation, because it may come up if you are looking to broaden your playgroup. You may have to address this, and having a way to handle that and be prepared to do it is, I think, a good look.
Since this is just sort of a very concrete topic, how do you deal with it when people come back with a response, which I feel like is always there, that, well, their creativity or their personality is being repressed if you're calling out that kind of behavior?
Good. You should repress that personality.
If no, your personality is about offending others, be a better person.
I think this actually gets at one of the harder questions, which I have in the notes here to get to eventually, which is, you know, it's great to set expectations. It's great to stand up for people and, you know, say when things are not to the standard you expect. But at some point, it's possible that people just won't listen to you, right? If it's the third week in a row that so-and-so has showed up with the playmat that you keep telling them you don't want at your cube draft, you know, at some point, you just have to accept that that person is not compatible with your group and, you know, try and cut ties with them and make it clear that they're not invited to future cube drafts. And they don't get to be on the Discord server where the whole playgroup is organizing events because they are not conforming with community standards. And I hope it doesn't get to that place with a lot of people. I hope what this is mostly doing is setting expectations and having people self-select, as you mentioned, Jen. Like, people recognizing that, okay, if my playmat isn't welcome, then I'm not showing up either. It's like, okay, great. You go find your people then. But for those that don't self-select, you know, the time might come where you actually really have to put your foot down and just draw a hard line, which is going to be hard to do for anybody, I think.
Yeah, I benefit from being a loud and confrontational person in these sort of situations. But like, conflict is, people are conflict avoidant for very good reasons, and a lot of times for very personal reasons. And getting to a point where you have to make the decision to engage in conflict because the alternative is allowing your playgroup and play space to be unwelcoming, it's hard. Kind of taking the first steps in that regard, I think, can genuinely be difficult. Once you have taken those steps, it becomes very easy. Making it known that this sort of behavior is unacceptable, once people know that, enforcing it is significantly easier than starting the policy. It is why one of the things that I will recommend to any play space is have actual community rules, community guidelines posted somewhere in the Discord. If you meet physically and it's like more than just somebody's living room, in a physical space, having something, even if it's incredibly simple and incredibly generic, to point to and be like, hey, this kind of violates the be nice clause of our community guidelines. That can go a great way to making kind of that conflict easier. Because engaging in conflict with people is hard. Engaging in conflict where all you're doing is trying to enforce a preset rule, that's easier.
For sure.
I think that's a great point. And also the fact that I think so many local playgroups do have Discord as a major component, just because it's really practical to have a space to organize things. And it's convenient that that does just give a central place to put those kinds of rules and documentation.
I just want to chime in, like, 100% agree that conflict is hard and talking to people about inappropriate behavior, it's not easy. I want to plus one Jen and say it does get easier with time. And if it's hard for you at your playgroup, I bet it's hard for you at work and with your family too.
Tara spitting.
So what a great place to kind of practice and rather low stakes way. Nidra Glover Tawab is one of my favorite authors and Instagram people on boundaries. Her book, Set Boundaries, Find Peace, A Guide to Reclaiming Yourself, is it's dog-eared and I keep reading it, but it's hard, and future you will find it easier and be more at peace in your life. And that's worth it.
I think Tara may slightly underestimate how significant magic is to a lot of magic players. Like, low stakes is not necessarily how magic players think of these spaces. No, I mean, the culture is just, I think, very unique among many gaming spaces, where the amount of engagement and dedication that people have is wild in this game.
Well, then try setting boundaries at work or with your mom, and then bring it
You got to practice on your mom so you can be ready for the play group.
So step one is teach your mom how to play magic, and then establish boundaries.
Perfect.
I want to move on because we have so much more to cover, but the last thing I want to highlight about this first thought of yours, Jen, is you did say publicly correct them. And I want to emphasize publicly here, because I don't know where this comes from, but I think a lot of people have it in their minds that it's somehow better or like more polite to address things privately. Like, if someone says something, you just, you know, later on text them and say like, hey man, it wasn't cool when you said whatever. But that is actually kind of the opposite of what is true. It is so much better to find a way to correct them publicly, because then everyone else in earshot, the person that this, you know, infraction was done to, if there is a target of it, they will know that you are affirming the sort of values of the space. And if you do it silently, then you might as well not have done it at all, right? Maybe you get that one person to not do that one thing again in the future, but in terms of everybody else involved in that issue or that witnessed what went down, they have just kind of learned that that can happen here and there are no public consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll do an allegory that I think people will appreciate. For people who play competitive Magic, I'm assuming most people have been deck checked at one point or another. And there is a special kind of fear for Magic players when they're shuffling up for their next round and there's a judge standing right behind them, like staring at their match. they immediately are like, oh my God, I'm going to get deck checked. Let me double check that I de-sideboarded. Let me make sure that I counted my cards correctly, that I'm not presenting an illegal deck, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll spoil a bit of kind of open secret judge strategy, but judges very rarely stand at the table that they intend to deck check, because you effectively get to deck check an extra person by doing so. You stand at one table and then you grab a table four tables down that you're keeping an eye out of the corner of your eye. But you publicly being there, kind of being that presence in the space, means people are less likely to try and cheat, and less likely to try and submit an illegal deck. And it's the same thing correcting people publicly. People seeing you present, seeing you doing things in the space, makes them more cautious. And hopefully your playgroup is full of people who don't need to be cautious. But not every playgroup is going to be like that. And as you pointed out, Cube being a format that needs eight people can sometimes lead to kind of more like, I'll take whoever shows up so I can get to eight sort of environments. Being present and being seen to publicly correct people puts that same fear of like, oh, this person, I might get talked to about this if I do something wrong.
Right.
There's an interesting allegory or sort of a connection there that you're making me think of, which is the fact that we are sort of playing a game that is already in this space that can have real conflict. And I definitely feel that a lot of people are probably conflict averse. I certainly am. It's not comfortable to call somebody out. And the first time I ever got a judge call in a serious event was, it was mortifying. Like, I was like, oh no, I've made a mistake and I'm going to be kicked out of the event. And I've
the police are here.
The police are here. Exactly. And the reality is, once you sort of play a little bit more and you do some more formal events, the idea that the judges are there to help you, you might make mistakes and they are there to help correct, and they will penalize you if you did make a mistake, but it's not the end of the world and we can get through those conflicts. And I think that maybe many of our listeners can relate to that experience of becoming comfortable with those small conflicts that we can move past and learn from.
Absolutely. And if I'll take a minute just to talk about how judges can play in here. Like, Cube is a very egalitarian format, and not many Cube groups are going to have a dedicated judge. There are just now some Cube conventions popping up that do. I'm very excited about that, of course, being one of the people on the organizing committee for KubeCon. But this applies to anywhere that you're playing in Magic. Judges are genuinely an amazing group of people. They want to help you. They want to make sure that you feel safe. They want to make sure that you feel respected in these spaces. It can be very daunting and difficult to speak on your own behalf and call a judge if you think that somebody is invalidating you or making you uncomfortable. But I have gotten to know so many judges over the past few years working the convention circuit, and they are all genuinely just amazing people who are so ready and willing to help you if you need help. And I know that it's scary, and I know that especially new players don't know the judges as well as a lot of the players who are kind of ingrained in competitive Magic. But the judges are genuinely a great group of people who are incredibly excited, ready, and willing to help you in whatever you need. Even if it's just like, hey, I'm sorry that's happening, I'll keep an eye on it. Judges will be very happy to do that. And that kind of reporting helps judges keep players accountable. If you're kind of uncomfortable and you say something to a judge, and then that same player does something that makes somebody else kind of uncomfortable later, that sort of pattern of behavior, judges take that into account when deciding how they want to handle situations. So it can be, especially as a member of a marginalized community in this space, it can be very scary and very hard to go to judges and speak on your own behalf. Do so if you can. If you see other people who are struggling to do it because they are marginalized people and can't and feel like they can't speak for themselves, you can speak on their behalf, either with their permission or even like, if you see somebody being kind of sexist, going to a judge and being like, hey, that match over there, the guy seems to be being kind of aggressive, and I don't know how the femme presenting person is feeling. Judges will go and check it out and listen in and see if anything needs doing.
I love calling judges. It's like my favorite activity.
It's a great pastime.
Yeah.
I want to move on to the next tweet you posted, again, back in January, Jen, about this issue of how to make your playgroup more inclusive. And you said, acknowledge these communities directly, these communities being underrepresented communities, directly in some way. My store runs a Queer Magic Night monthly, which is a known safe space for queer people and lets those curious about the game play in an environment surrounded by others with shared experiences and identities. I am curious to know from you, Jen, or anybody else, how people that are trying to organize their own local playgroup but don't have these shared experiences or identities, they are not queer, they are not women, they're not underrepresented groups, how they can do something similar, how they can formally, you know, acknowledge other groups of people in the game.
A big part of it is, as I said, with community rules, like even something as simple and low effort as having a community rules that is just like, this is a LGBTQ safe space. This is a safe space for people of color. Even something so low effort as that can mean the world to a lot of people. Having any acknowledgement is unique in a place, in a kind of space that acknowledgement is so infrequent. For me personally, like my game store ran this event before I worked there. Another one of the organizers at the game store still is a queer person and ran that because they thought that it was important to them and the community. And when I wandered in the game store, that was like 4 years ago, I wasn't really playing Magic. I wasn't really doing any Magic. I was working in political organizing at the time. And I genuinely don't know if I would be a judge or be doing anything that I'm doing in work now or being on this podcast if I hadn't seen that sign advertising Queer Magic Night and been able to go feel safe going to it.
I think just the point of just stating it is often overlooked, right? People think that there is like that it doesn't bear stating because it's like obvious to them or whatever. But, you know, just knowing that somebody that reads that this is a rule here, we, you know, respect these kinds of people, some people are going to be turned off by that. They're going to, you know, they're going to walk away from the space because of that. And somebody else reading those rules, reading those expectations, is going to know that certain other people are going to be, you know, pushed away. And that's going to make that space a better place for them to be. So just stating things is, I think, really important. I'll add one thing that I think has been helpful for our group in this regard, which is playing in a queer-friendly space. I mean, we meet every Tuesday at a local game store and bar in Baltimore called No Land Beyond, and No Land Beyond is a space that is queer-friendly. They have queer-specific events. In fact, the first Tuesday of every month is also the Queer Alliance meeting, so that night we are playing Cube, and there's also a whole big Queer Alliance meeting going on, and oftentimes we lose some of our regulars that go to the Queer Alliance event instead.
And if we get lucky, we can siphon off a few people and recruit some new players.
And so knowing that even if you're going to go do something new, you're going to go play Cube with a new group, there's a lot of unknowns there. But knowing that you're in a space that is not going to be a space where you won't be welcome, I think goes a really long way to helping people that are in a play group that maybe has not made an effort before or finds themselves, overrepresented by certain communities. Making sure that you're playing in a space where other people will be welcome, I think makes all the difference.
There's a lot to it also that is beyond kind of just policy level. Like, I think that something that people maybe overlook a little bit is the practical parts. Does your group meet at a store that has one really gross bathroom that is, you know, you have to go through a storage room to get there and it feels kind of sketchy and it doesn't have a bin? Like, that's going to put off a lot of people, right? Like, does your group meet at a store where all the staff are men? And so it's a lot of the little subtle things, like, do you meet at a time where people who have a lot of childcare duties would be able to attend? And I think that, you know, people don't really think about these things as they're not direct forms of exclusion, but they're kind of the same for everyone, but they're going to affect certain groups much more than they're going to affect other groups. Like, is your store safe to go to? And is it in a location that somebody who is femme presenting would be comfortable going to and leaving at 11 o'clock at night? You know, like, I think that that's a lot of stuff that people tend not to think about because it's just their default. Like, they've always met there or they've always been in this environment or this scenario. But that's something to really, I think, actively think about, as well as trying to find these more open, more direct, inclusive spaces.
Yeah. And I know that this is hard for a lot of people. I mean, if the most common question we get is how do we get 8 people together to draft my cube, probably the second most common question is like, how do I get my local game store on board with me doing a cube night, given that it doesn't inherently put money in their pockets, and how do I find a place that is receptive to the kind of Magic I want to play? So if finding a place is already difficult for you, and now we're adding this layer on top of like, oh, and also make sure that place is a welcoming space, a space that is, you know, accommodating to people of all different backgrounds, that can feel like it's making it more difficult. But again, in the big picture, I think taking time to think about this and think about whether or not you do want to meet at the local game store, which I've been to a lot of local game stores, I'm sure everyone on this call, save for maybe Tara, has, where, yeah, you know, the bathroom is disgusting and it's got a bin full of half-used deodorants because they want to have deodorant on hand for all their stinky players at pre-release. And there's a little sign on the bin that says, put deodorant on. And it's like, this is not the culture that is going to bring in people of all different backgrounds. So making an effort, and maybe you can't meet your local game store. Maybe you have to meet at a brewery, or you have to meet at a park or a library or some other sort of public space. We've talked about other places you can meet in past episodes, and you can refer back to those. But being conscious of how people that do not have your exact perspective on the world might feel in a given space, I think, is really important.
Although I wonder if there might even be opportunities there. You know, if you're trying to meet up at a local game store and their space is not welcoming, there's potentially opportunities to work with a local game store, and you're helping them make their store more appealing to a broader base as well. Assuming you can frame that conversation with them in a way that doesn't feel antagonistic.
Yeah, I think it's going to be hard unless you have a standing relationship with a person that runs that store. But if somewhere out there somebody is going to help make their game store a more accessible place because of this conversation, because you're trying to make your cube group a more accessible cube group, that's a fantastic outcome from this conversation. We are out of time. I feel like there's so much more for us to talk about, but also so much we already covered. So I want to make sure I'm sensitive to everybody's time and get you all out of here on time. So thank you all for joining us. This was a great conversation.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thanks. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, I really enjoyed being here. Thank you.
Real quick, just want to go around the horn to see if anybody has anything they want to promote or point people to. Obviously, I assume the VML is something you want to promote, but Haiyu, let's start with you. What else do you want to point people to? Your social media or whatever?
I would just say check out the VML. I am on Twitter at Nephet, N-I-P-H-E-T-T-E, but right now I would say, you know, I'm trying to be good to my mental health and not be on there very much. But you can catch me also broadcasting tournaments like the Arena Championships and the Magic Online Champions Showcase. So yeah, I'll see you there.
What about you, Jen?
Easiest place to reach me, follow me on Twitter at Jen_the_judge. Catch me at effectively any Comp Ariel convention in North America at this rate. Come to KubeCon this October. I'll definitely be there, unsurprisingly. Play in the VML if you're the kind of person who that speaks to.
And then Tara, I'll link your website in the show notes, of course, so anybody who might be in need of your services can find you. But when can we get you playing Cube? I mean, I got to imagine you're close after this conversation.
Absolutely. I'm messaging Haiyu after this call to be like, where's, how, blah, blah, what next? How, Vancouver, where, please?
I feel like Haiyu will be a great introduction to the local Cube scene there in Vancouver. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. All of our music is produced by DJ James Nasty. All the Magic cards are produced by Wizards of the Coast. This podcast is produced by all five of us getting on a Zoom call and talking about these issues for a full hour and a half. Thank you, everybody, again, for joining us. This was fantastic.
Yay!
Thank you for having us.
Thank you all for coming on.